Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Kimberly Ann Elliott on globalization, and especially where that concerns agriculture. But right now, Linda Siegel is here, legislative correspondent for KSFR, with today's legislative update. Welcome, Linda.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
So the session is winding down or accelerating to a close, or what's going on?
Well, it's certainly accelerating. Of course, the last few days of any legislative session, the Senate and the House start meeting long hours. The Senate was on the floor till about 10 o'clock last night, so things are heating up, and of course, the governor hasn't gotten some of the big things that he wants, so it's heating up even more.
What are some of the things that he has not gotten?
Well, health care reform was his big issue for this legislative session. Now, the House has passed a scaled-down version of his bill, and part of the things that were in that bill that were important to him were that every person in New Mexico had to have insurance. Well, that's taken out. Also, that employers who didn't provide insurance would have to pay into a fund. That's taken out. So that bill, which is somewhat stripped, has passed the House of Representatives and today is sitting in Senate Finance. Well, Senate Finance hasn't met for 2 days, so we don't know what's going to happen with that bill. But in the meantime, last night, the Senate took two of their health care bills, pulled them out of Senate Finance Committee without a hearing, put them on the floor, and passed them out and sent them over to the House. And those bills are very different from the governor's stripped-down bill coming over to the Senate than the bills going over from the Senate to the House.
I didn't know you were allowed to do that.
You can do just about anything you want to in the legislature.
And so What do those bills say?
Well, one of them, which is Senator Jennings' bill, creates a health interim committee and a human services interim committee and charges the health interim committee to work with the Health Policy Commission and create a plan for future health care delivery in New Mexico. And then the second one is Senator Feldman's bill, which it initially created a health authority, but now creates a health care and policy commission, which also combines the Health Policy Commission, which is an existing government entity, and has appointed members, some appointed by the governor, some appointed by the legislature, and also has the task of looking at health insurance and health care delivery in New Mexico over the next year and coming up with a plan to bring back to the legislature.
And so the stripped-down version, we found out a lot of things that it doesn't have in it. What does it still have in it?
Well, it still has the creation of a health care authority made up of appointees by the legislature and the governor. And it still has time frames for incorporating all the other government-run health plans that exist, like the school public health authority and the retiree health authority. So it brings all of these existing pools into what would be this huge pool eventually, and that which would provide health care for everybody. So that is a big thing, and that is very controversial among those other pools.
Meanwhile, what it looks like right now is we're not going to be getting any major changes in the coming year. Even if some of these bills do pass, there's not going to be any changes that affect the citizens of the state.
That's probably true, and the biggest problem is the state doesn't have any money. What's interesting is the House passed a tax cut that for next year is only $4 million, but by 2012 would be $20 million. And the legislature is projecting revenues, recurring revenues for next year of only $200 million. So we can't really afford health care reform at the moment, it appears.
At least not simultaneous with tax cuts.
Yes, right.
What else is happening in the legislature that you'd like to inform our listeners about?
Well, the domestic partner bill, which had passed the House and passed one of the committees in the Senate, has been tabled in Senate Judiciary, and so it looks like that bill is dead for the year, but it just means that it'll be back again next year.
Anything else?
That'll do it, Mary Charlotte.
Linda Siegel is KSFR's legislative correspondent. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. I'd like now to welcome Sandy Buffett, who is sitting with us in the cafe, Santa Fe Baking Company. She's the executive director of Conservation Voters New Mexico and CVNM Education Fund. Welcome.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Great to be here.
Good to have you. You are paying us a brief visit because this is the legislative session, and you've also got some things going on. One of them is the so-called abandoned uranium mine reclamation bills.
Yes, we really could use the help of all your listeners out there today, so I encourage folks to grab a pen and a piece of paper while I talk about these bills that are being pushed by the uranium mining industry.
Now, uranium mine reclamation, what is that?
Well, so-called uranium mine reclamation bills, these are bills that are industry-backed by the uranium mining industry, mining companies, that are seeking to revive uranium mining here in New Mexico. And as you may know, we have a toxic legacy of the last boom and bust cycle when uranium miners came in and left a legacy of toxic pollution across the northwest part of our state. So what they are seeking to do is, I believe, inappropriately link the cleanup of the old abandoned uranium mines of the past to new uranium mining exploration. So they're saying, hey, issue the permits and let us generate revenue, and part of that revenue then will help clean up the old mines. Well, we certainly need to clean up the old mines, but we don't want to perversely link it to creating more of the problem. So these bills, unfortunately, they don't hold the former operators accountable, so it lets the former polluters off the hook. And the revenue won't also come close to the true cost of cleanup. So we're asking your listeners today to call Governor Bill Richardson and the Speaker of the House, Ben Lujan. So let me provide those phone numbers. Governor Bill Richardson is at 476-2200, and Speaker Ben Lujan can be reached at 986-4782.
Now, is this one of those bills where the name of it is not consistent with what the language of the bill says?
Well, they're often written that way to seem more benign than they are. But these bills have really been taken over and amended by the industry, and we need the help of the governor and the speaker to defeat these bills. So the numbers of the bills are SB 487, that's Senate Bill 487, and HB House Bill 342. So please ask the governor and the speaker to help us defeat these bills.
Now, it's something that we talk about in various times on this show is when somebody digs into the ground, are they then responsible for the mess they make?
That's called the polluter pays principle. And with mining and the uranium mining industry, the history is that, no, they have walked away from the problem.
And it ends up being a problem of the taxpayers.
It does. It ends up privatizing gains and socializing the losses. And with the uranium mining, it would affect the sole source of drinking water for many of the Navajos in the Northwest. So we can't afford to have another boom and bust cycle of uranium mining in the state.
If people are driving and they did not have their pencils and papers ready, how can they reach you or reach Conservation
Sure.
Voters New Mexico?
Well, everything I just said is up on our Take Action section of our website, which is www.cvnm.org. That's for Conservation Voters New Mexico. And just click on the Take Action site. Take 2 minutes of your time and make phone calls. Help us stop those bills.
Sandy Buffett is Executive Director of Conservation Voters New Mexico. Thanks so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Kimberly Ann Elliott. She is a senior fellow with the Peterson Institute for International Economics and the author of several books, including her latest, Delivering on Doha, Farm, Trade, and the Poor. And she will be speaking this Thursday, February 14th, in a lecture sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. That's at 5 o'clock at the Forum on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. She'll be talking about global economic challenges. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So I've been reading this this book of yours on farm trade, and I think it's really worth discussing some of the details on this. As first of all, they're very important, and second, nobody understands them. I'm still struggling. First of all, rich countries like the United States subsidize their farmers. Why do they do this, and how do they do it?
Oh, my. The why is something I'm still struggling with. Having written this book, it's not very clear, because it started back in the 1930s, at least in the United States, during the Great Depression, when, you know, obviously there was the Dust Bowl, there was the Depression, farm prices were just crashing, and so there was a real need. And of course, there was high unemployment in the cities, and the government didn't want the farmers all moving into the cities and adding to the problems there. So they introduced subsidies then in order to try and keep farmers on the land and to try and improve their incomes. Of course, you know, here we are some 70 years later, farm incomes on average are no longer lower than urban incomes. They are slightly above it on average. That's not true of all farmers, obviously. Most people, I think, believe that we are subsidizing small family farms, and many of us would be perfectly fine with that, you know, to get them through hard times. Unfortunately, that's not what happens. Most of the subsidies go to the top 10% of very large farm operations. And so there's really, so the why we continue to do this, is actually a real puzzle. It doesn't make a lot of sense in policy terms. I don't think it makes a lot of sense to me as a taxpayer.
So that's the why, and we can go into that some more when we start talking about the international trade part of it. How do they do it? How do subsidies actually work?
Well, when you get to the how part, then we have to distinguish a little bit between the United States and most other rich countries in the world. Most other rich countries support their farmers primarily through trade barriers and through controlling supplies in order to prop up prices. So most other countries, consumers pay the price of supporting farmers. In the United States, we're different in that we do, in part because we are a farm exporting nation. We don't want to keep prices so high that we can't sell on international markets. So what we do is we just pay farmers when prices are low. We just send them checks. And that's for most commodities, for corn, wheat, soybeans. So right now, when in part because of the ethanol boom, prices are fairly high, farmers aren't getting checks, but nevertheless, those payments are sort of there as a backstop if prices go down again.
Well, you say in Europe it comes out of the pockets of the citizens, but it does for us too.
Oh, it does. It's just it comes out of their pockets as consumers when they go to the grocery store and they buy food. In the United States, it comes out of our pockets as taxpayers. We have to pay taxes that are then transferred to these farmers who, again, in many cases are wealthier than those who are paying the taxes that subsidize them.
So how do subsidies play into the politics of international trade, the international trade of agricultural products?
Sure. If I could say one other thing before I go to the international trade piece of it, the other thing that it's important to understand about U.S. farm subsidies is that only about half of farm operations receive them. You know, I mentioned corn, soybeans. It's the grains and a few other products, peanuts. Half of U.S. farm operations, those producing fruits and vegetables, so like in New Mexico, Chile's, don't get any subsidies, or very, very little in the way of subsidies. And so there's another disparity in how we do it. In terms of the international trade talks, these are talks that have been going on in Geneva at the World Trade Organization since 2001. They were originally scheduled to conclude at the end of 2004. Here we are a little over three years later. And one of the major reasons that these international trade talks have not been concluded is because of not just the U.S., but the U.S. plus Europe plus Japan and some others, other rich countries, not wanting to significantly reduce the levels of support, these subsidies and the trade barriers that are provided to farmers in our countries.
Well, this is something that is, I think, quite difficult and confusing. So farmers are basically subsidized and supported by their own countries, and that creates an unlevel playing field, not only among rich countries, but especially between rich and poor countries.
Exactly, because in fact, I mean, in the United States and most other rich countries, farmers are, you know, 5% or less of total employment in our countries. But in poor countries, most people, 60 to 70% of people live in rural areas, are dependent in one way or another on agriculture, and are extremely poor. But their governments, A, can't afford to provide them subsidies, and so B, when they go to sell on international, to try and sell their products on international markets, they're facing prices that are 10 to 15% lower depending on the product because of U.S. and European and Japanese subsidies and trade barriers.
So what happens in trade talks? Because, of course, the interests of wealthy countries and poor countries are not the same.
No, the idea is that it's a reciprocal bargain. And so the idea is that we, you know, should lower our barriers to things that they export, and that's principally agriculture and clothing and footwear that are labor-intensive, take lots of labor. And in exchange, they open their markets to things that we're competitive in. So capital goods, you know, machinery in factories that they need to help make them more competitive and to develop their economies, but where they may have, for similar kinds of, you know, rent-seeking, you know, reasons, they have their own trade barriers. And so that's supposed to be the bargain, is that we drop barriers in areas where they might be competitive and they drop barriers in areas where we could export more.
And does that actually happen in these talks?
You know, it's a mixed bag. If you go back, you know, two or three decades, actually, you know, the rich countries really were such a major part of the economy that they mostly conducted the talks among themselves. And so we negotiated with the Europeans and the Japanese and the Canadians and figured out what we were interested in and lowered our tariffs on things that we were interested in exporting to one another. The developing countries, the poorer countries, were able to benefit to some degree from that model of trade negotiations because under the international trade rules, there's something called most favored nation. And what it means is that any tariff cut reduction that we provide to any of our trading partners that are members of the World Trade Organization, we have to provide to all of the members across the board. And so they could benefit from those reductions, except that we weren't doing it in the areas of interest to them, agriculture and clothing and footwear. And so it was only in the 1980s and 1990s that developing countries really started to assert themselves in international trade talks and to try and to make this, to broaden the bargains to things that they were interested in. In the last round in the 1980s, it was called the Uruguay Round, that happened to a degree. The rich countries did, in fact, agree to get rid of quotas, of quantitative restrictions on exports of clothing from developing countries. In theory, the rich countries said that they would also reduce these subsidies and trade barriers to agriculture, but in practice, there was so much flexibility and so the fudge factor around how those agricultural rules were going to be implemented that, in fact, the U.S., Europe, Japan, very little actual reduction in the agricultural barriers occurred. And so that's why it's become really the central issue in these new negotiations that are going on now.
And so, I mean, I would think if I were a small, poor country, I would say it's not fair in terms of international trade that you subsidize your own farmers, and therefore, when we can do things at a better price, we can't sell them. But to get a country to stop, a wealthy country to stop supporting its farmers seems impossible.
Well, it has been very difficult. In fact, if there's a farm bill pending before Congress right now, that unfortunately would not do anything to help us in these international trade negotiations. It either maintains or increases the level of subsidies to most products, and it does some other things that where, you know, we've already had actually Brazil brought a complaint against the United States in the World Trade Organization several years ago, and some of our cotton subsidies were found to all, you know, forget any new subsidies or any new trade agreement under the previous trade agreement. We found that some of our cotton subsidies were too high and were distorting world markets. And this new farm bill doesn't do anything to fix that, unfortunately. So So certainly in the United States, as I mentioned previously, it's a real puzzle to many of us because farm prices are very high right now. Farm incomes are very high. Farmers are just doing great right now. And yet, even in this situation, we can't seem to find the political will, or at least Congress can't find the political will to cut these subsidies. Japan and Korea and many of the northern European countries are very similar. The European Union, which has expanded from 15 to 25 countries, they brought in a lot of the, after the end of the Cold War, brought in, 10 new members from Eastern Europe that are, A, somewhat more dependent on agriculture, and B, poorer. So Europe has actually done a little bit more in terms of moving in the direction of reform, because they don't want to have to spend many billions more dollars or euros in order to support these new countries that are coming into their union.
We're talking to Kimberly Ann Elliott. So when you have, for example, something like NAFTA, which is supposedly about, quote-unquote, free trade, how does the whole agricultural sector figure into the rules that are in NAFTA?
Well, NAFTA actually is one of the agreements, perhaps because it occurred very early on. It was the first, not the first, but one of the early bilateral free trade agreements that the United States signed. And actually, as of January 1 of this year, all agricultural products were supposed to be subject to free trade. All restrictions. Now, and this is a problem for Mexico. So all the trade barriers were lifted as of January 1, 2008. It's virtually the only trade agreement where that's true. Since then, there have been restrictions on some of the sensitive products. The problem for Mexico, and one of the things that their farmers are concerned about, is that the agreement addresses only tariffs and quotas, the quantitative restrictions. It does not address subsidies. And so that has been of concern to Mexico's corn and bean farmers in particular, who are, very small, not very productive, and potentially quite vulnerable to an increase in imports.
Well, I mean, not only potentially vulnerable, I mean, this, many farmers have, in fact, lost their land. Have they not in Mexico?
There have been some problems in Mexico. In some ways, NAFTA has gotten a bit of a bum rap, though, on that particular, on sort of the past history. And that's because, NAFTA was signed, recall, back in 1993 and began to be implemented in 1994. Corn, beans were subject to very long phase-ins in terms of the when the liberalization would occur, and those products just happened this year. So what happened with corn farmers, which have gotten a lot of attention in Mexico, is that Mexico's own policies, for a variety of reasons, they let in far more corn than they were required to do under NAFTA, actually. Partly, and the other thing about U.S.-Mexico and NAFTA that's a little bit, that a lot of people don't understand, is that what Mexican peasants grow is what is called white corn, which, for human consumption, that goes in tortillas and that sort of thing. Most of what the U.S. grows, and particularly what it exports, is yellow corn that's used for animal feed. And so what happened was Mexico wanted to lower the price of corn that was going to its poultry and pork farmers into the meat sector in order to lower their costs. And so now that, nevertheless, there is a connection between, the prices for yellow and white corn. And so it did clearly have some effect on those farmers. But the role of NAFTA in it has gotten a little bit, I think, exaggerated.
Let's go back historically a little bit. The United States has vast amounts of farmland, but you write in your book that the United States in the 19th century protected manufacturing at the expense of agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
That's actually, again, a fairly common pattern, and we saw it in developing countries until today's developing countries until very fairly recently, where you have, as countries develop, a process of in the United States, both immigrants coming from outside the country, but also migrants within the country from rural areas to urban areas, and you're trying to build up manufacturing. Many governments over the years through history have chosen to subsidize the urban consumers of food at the expense of their agricultural sector. And that is what we saw in the 19th century, really up until the Great Depression.
And so in the Great Depression, these subsidies happened. But then, I mean, I remember in the 1980s, for example, thousands and thousands of farmers lost their farms. It was a national
right.
tragedy resulting in all sorts of suicides and mental illness and stuff mm-hmm. in the United States. What happened?
Well, what you had there was sort of in some ways, a perfect storm of bad events. You had the U.S. dollar was very strong in the first half of the 1980s, which both penalized our exports of agricultural products and made imports relatively cheaper. This was at sort of the same time that the European Union was increasing its level of subsidies to its agriculture. So you had, you know, sort of imports coming in, fewer exports going out. And, of course, we had in the first part of the 80s, the oil crises, and the Federal Reserve responded to that by I don't know if you also remember this, but jacking up interest rates very, very high. And so since many, many farmers, you know, have to borrow sort of seasonally in order to, you know, they borrow in order to put the crop in, and then they pay it off when they sell the crop later. But when you have very, very high interest rates, it was a big burden on our farmers. And then I think there were also some weather events that added to the problems that we saw in that period. So it was just kind of several things came together and really hit farmers very badly in that period.
So you talk about liberalization. First of all, just for our listeners, what does the word liberalization actually mean? It's one that's a word that's often thrown around when you're talking about trade mm-hmm. negotiations.
Mm-hmm. In general, it basically means lowering whatever barriers you have to trade. So you know, charging a tax on an import is called a tariff, is one. Quotas, which put quantitative restrictions on imports, or you know, sort of in a very broad sense, lowering the subsidy payments would be part of liberalizing our farm policy, making it more open.
And so liberalization, does it help or would it help the poor people in poor countries?
You know, it actually turns out to be a little bit more of a complicated story. In the long run, again, it almost surely would, because this is an area of comparative advantage for many, many developing countries. In the short run, there could be some sort of adjustment problems. Partly, it goes to this issue about consumption versus production. Clearly, getting rid of the subsidies and trade barriers is good for poor country producers of farm goods who would expect to get a higher price. But, of course, higher prices are not so good for consumers. And so it depends from country to country sort of what the balance is between the production and the, you know, the rural and the urban sectors and how that all plays out. But so it's you know, a little bit more complicated than some of the rhetoric makes it seem. Having said that, I think the price effects, you know, for both good and ill, the estimates are, would not be huge. So it's not going to be a panacea for poor country farmers, but neither should it be a major problem or one that is not, that governments can't handle in terms of increased prices for consumers. Now, one of the crops that has gotten particular attention, actually, in the international trade negotiations is cotton. I mentioned before that Brazil brought a case against U.S. cotton subsidies, and they were found to be to violate our commitments under the international trade rules. And there are four countries in particular in West Africa that are very poor and that are very highly reliant on cotton exports, both in terms of jobs for people and in terms of export revenues, in terms of the value of their exports. And obviously cotton is not, you know, is not food. So that's been kind of one that has gotten a great deal of attention, because there the effects of U.S. subsidies are just purely negative. There is no sort of defense. And the cotton farmers in the United States are you know, among some of the larger operations. Now, I'm not going to say that these are, you know, sort of really rich people. I grew up, or my family grew up, actually, in the panhandle of Texas, right next door to where you are. And so, I know that these are not people that are just sort of wallowing in luxury, but nevertheless clearly have an advantage vis-a-vis, you know, very poor cotton farmers in Mali. And so that has been a big problem for the U.S. image internationally and in the trade negotiations.
What does the U.S., for example, cotton industry look like right now? I mean, the history of the U.S. cotton industry is slavery. What happened then? Mm-hmm. Is it huge plantations? Is it small farmers? What does it actually look like?
They're not all, or as I said, I'm from Texas, so I sort of know cotton farming in Texas better than I know what the situation is today in Mississippi. They do tend to be, though, on the relatively large side in terms of acreage. Obviously today, in part, frankly, because of not first the end of slavery and then later the end of sharecropping, which came very close to slavery in some cases, it is now almost completely mechanized. And so if you drive through cotton country, there are these, you know, huge combines and the ginners and all of this stuff, the balers, I'm sorry. So they are large operations. These are not small farmers. And they are one of the more highly, at least according to some estimates that we did for the book, one of the more highly subsidized sectors in the U.S. farm economy.
So where are trade negotiations at right now in terms of international policy, and what's coming next? Where do the various interest groups line up?
Well, the talks are going on in Geneva. They are... typically the way the talks work is that you get a sort of a framework for how what the rules are going to be in each sector, leaving sort of to the end the most difficult questions about, okay, how much are things really going to be cut or liberalized? And then you try to bring in all of the sectors together. So, and when I say that, I mean agriculture. I'm talking broad sector. So agriculture, and then we have a set of talks on what's called non-agricultural manufacturing, so basically all other goods. And then the other large chunk is services negotiations. And the idea is then to try and, once you sort of cut deals within sectors, then to try and deal with the remaining hard things by doing deals across sectors. So where the negotiators are in Geneva right now is they're still trying to come up with just a framework for agriculture. They've been working on the non-agricultural framework, but that's kind of lagging because everybody's waiting to see, you know, is there going to be a breakthrough in agriculture? And especially the developing countries are saying, you know, we're not going to offer our bottom line in non-ag or in services until we see what the rich countries put on the table in agriculture. And if that's not enough, then we're not going to move forward. And so that's kind of where we've been hung up.
Do the poor countries have more clout than they did when this whole thing first started?
Absolutely. I mean, in part, just having been through the Uruguay round, they now have negotiators who have experience in these things. They've also become more adept at negotiating as a group. If you compare sort of what's on the table in Geneva in these multilateral trade talks to what's negotiated in some the bilaterals, you know, I mentioned with NAFTA that it didn't include subsidies because the U.S. can just say, I'm not talking about that in a bilateral, but in the multilateral where they're negotiating with, you know, 100 developing countries rather than one or two, you know, they have to address things that are of interest to the developing countries. And so definitely this is a very different round in terms of the role and the negotiating leverage of the developing countries than what we've seen in the past.
Well, would the poor countries that are involved in these negotiations, if they could get what they wanted, would they say, we want absolutely free trade with no tariffs and no subsidies? So in other words, rich mm-hmm. countries may not subsidize their farmers anymore.
They might like it, but they know that's not where this is going to come out. Everybody recognizes that, you know, this is going to be, it's going to be partial liberalization, partial reduction of subsidies. And so what they're really, I think, a key aim is simply to avoid what happened in the last negotiation where there were sort of cuts in subsidies and barriers on paper, but not in practice. So there's much more focus this time on sort of the process of implementation and what the rules are about how things are measured even. I mean, it's very, very detailed kinds of things to try and make sure that they get some additional access in rich country markets and some reduction in subsidies so that, again, as I said, right now, in reality, the subsidies aren't having much effect because prices are so high. But it's very, farm prices are cyclical and they will go down at some point. And so they want some assurance, the developing countries want some assurance that when that happens, you know, the subsidies don't kick in again and then send the price even lower.
We're talking to Kimberly Ann Elliott. Another thing that I wanted to ask you about is global warming. So one of the things, I mean, if people ate, we talk about this on my program on a fairly regular basis, if people were to eat locally produced food as much as possible, there'd be a great reduction in greenhouse gases produced and the transportation of food. But the models you're talking about are all about importing and exporting food and other agricultural products across international boundaries for economic purposes. I mean, is there a model being discussed that includes both economic prosperity and eating locally produced food?
Well, I think the at least the research that I've seen suggests that in terms of the greenhouse gases, the sort of local versus imported is actually not so clear because people may have to drive much further to get to a farmer's market than to get to a grocery store that's around the corner. And so when you sort of add it all up, that particular piece isn't so clear. Now, I mean, I think there are other advantages. If, you know, for example, I don't have a farmer's market. I wish I did, and I certainly don't have one. I think I heard in your advertisement when I was waiting to come on that the Santa Fe farmer's market is open year-round.
That's right.
That is wonderful. I don't have one here that's open year-round. So, I mean, so the local can only be, you know, it's better, it's fresher. You know, I love going to them when I can find one, but it's not going to be a solution to all of our food problems. And as I said, you know, even in urban areas, it's, you know, people just may not have that as an option. So, and again, in terms of sort of the, when you add everything up and net it out, it's not clear on the greenhouse gases bit. And of course, there are other farm products that we simply can't get locally, you know, bananas or coffee, tea, these kinds of things. So there's always going to be trade. And I think the point is to try and, to get rid of the distortions from the subsidies so that we can actually, you know, so that the allocation of resources across these things is as efficient as possible. That's sort of the standard economist answer. And then the other thing I would say on global warming that I think is far more important is this biofuels and ethanol boom, and being very, very careful about. I mean, I think the subsidies there are potentially quite damaging because corn is simply not efficient as a source of ethanol. And so you end up saving very little in terms of greenhouse gases. You by raising food prices, you may encourage, you know, deforestation and slash and burn agriculture in the poor countries because their food prices are going up, so they want to clear more land. And the whole issue of land use and water use related to ethanol, I think, in terms of if we want to worry about links between agriculture and greenhouse gases and climate change, I think that sort of issue is one that needs a lot more attention, and we need to think much more carefully about what our policy is and what it ought to be.
Are there any international agreements in place or being worked on about ethanol and biofuels?
Not at the moment that I know of. Not at the sort of global level. Now, there was this recent agreement, very vague, but between the U.S. and Brazil to try and do something on ethanol cooperation. What that's going to be is a little bit difficult to know because, in fact, Brazil makes its ethanol from sugar, which is one of the, you know, clearly most efficient sources for ethanol. Yet we impose a 50-cent a gallon, I think it is, tariff on imported ethanol. Because we want to protect our corn farmers, get our ethanol from locally grown corn. And again, as I said, that has all kinds of negative effects.
Do you also look at issues like sustainable and unsustainable farming practices, you know, the degradation of topsoil, overuse of pesticides and things like that?
It's not something that I looked at very closely. That is something where I was hoping to see, you know, more reform in the U.S. Farm Bill, that it would move from sort of traditional subsidies that are linked to production to, and these kind of subsidies would be perfectly legitimate under the international trade rules, subsidies to farmers to be better stewards of the land, to conserve water and soil and to use better, more sustainable farming techniques. So I definitely think that is a direction that U.S. farm policy should move.
But there's, is there any sign of that yet?
Well, there, partial. In the, particularly in the Senate, Senator Harkin from Iowa is very interested in the conservation issues. And he did put in some additional, I believe the House did as well. I don't remember the numbers, but both houses, the House and the Senate, did put in some additional money for conservation programs. The problem was that they did not pay for that by reducing the traditional subsidies. And so the one of the issues hanging up the farm bill right now is how to pay for the increased spending because they couldn't, you know, bring themselves to cut anything. They just they added a little bit for conservation and a little bit for food stamps and a little bit, you know, for programs that many of us would say that's a good thing to be spending tax dollars on. But they didn't cut any of the trade-distorting production-linked subsidies in order to pay for that. So now they're trying to figure out, okay, how are they going to pay for the conservation and other useful programs?
So what about genetically modified foods? How does that the politics of that whole issue play into international trade negotiations, if it does?
Well, it's it has been a fairly big international trade issue, especially with the European Union. In terms of the trade rules, any restrictions on genetically modified crops are supposed to be science-based. And so so far, most of the cases that the U.S. has brought against Europe over their restrictions on genetically modified crops, the U.S. has won. But because it's so politically sensitive in Europe, we're still battling over how the decisions are going to be implemented and actually getting access for those things. My own sort of take on it from the, again, not being an expert, but from the literature I've seen, is that there simply is no scientific evidence that there is a public health risk from the genetically modified foods. I think there is some evidence and some you know new research coming out about the other environmental effects, that is, of these things you know straying out of the fields and creating you know pest resistant weeds or there was just an article I saw the other day that the BT cotton, which has this pesticide genetically modified into the cotton, that the boll weevils are now becoming resistant to that. Of course, they become resistant to any kind of pesticide, but it's the whether or not that then gets in, again, cross-fertilizes into other crops or into non-genetically modified cotton, you know. And we had a recent scandal or incident with rice where some genetically modified rice got into what was supposed to be non-genetically modified rice, and a lot of countries blocked our exports because they had not approved that particular variety of rice. So I think there are some environmental problems and definitely some trade problems that need to be resolved around the GMO issues.
We're talking to Kimberly Ann Elliott, and she's going to be in Santa Fe on Thursday, this Thursday, the 14th of February, at 5 o'clock at the Forum on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. What will you be talking about on Thursday?
I'm going to be talking a little more broadly, I think, on Thursday about the about challenges and opportunities around globalization. I think the title of the talk is something like Economic Challenges. I want to talk a little bit about the opportunities because I think those tend to get overlooked, but especially the anxieties that are evident in this election year among Americans about globalization and about what especially, you know, some trade policies, but I think even more so what domestic policies the United States needs to adopt and to strengthen in order to assuage those concerns about globalization. So things like dealing with health care so that people don't lose their insurance when they lose a job or lose their pension, the fact that we need to have, you know, improving the education and adult training systems so that people can upgrade their skills throughout their life and be more flexible if they lose a job. Hopefully it becomes easier to find a new job and to find a higher paying job if they have good skills. So those kinds of issues are at least part of what I want to talk about on Thursday.
So we've got just a couple of minutes left. How do the interests of wealthy countries and poor countries really get negotiated, and how do they line up with or really conflict with one another when you're talking about international trade? I mean, it seems like the United States and wealthy countries have really dominated the system and worked it to fit into their own interests.
Well, as I say, that is true. It's in part because developing countries for a very long time didn't participate in the system, so they didn't have sort of, in part from their own choice. They didn't want to open their own markets, and so they chose not to participate in this reciprocal bargaining process, and so that has had its effects. One of the things, I have to say is that while one of the both strengths but also a weakness of the World Trade Organization is that it is based on this reciprocal bargaining model. All the economic models will tell you that actually liberalizing our markets to trade is good for us, even if we do it unilaterally and nobody else does anything else. But it's become embedded in this process, this negotiating process, where we will only liberalize our market in exchange for others opening theirs. In that sense, any sort of deal that liberalizes markets, is in most countries' interest. There will be winners and losers within countries, and this is where I was talking about what we need to do domestically in order to ensure both that people can take advantage of globalization, but also that they are compensated if they lose in some fashion or are provided assistance. Countries, generally gain from doing this. So it's a little bit, the bargaining process kind of, puts an unfortunate spin on where the gains and the losses come from. Our gains come as much from the imports as from the exports. And in terms of the developing country part of it, as I said, I think that the history has contributed to sort of an imbalance in terms of the rules. But I think that is being rectified in this new round. And as I said, they are much more experienced. They have much, more capable negotiators now. And they are, I think if anything, the danger in this round is that the developing countries may overreact to sort of past grievances and end up blocking a deal that I think serves, the developing country interests more than the rich country interests at this stage. Because the rich country markets are relatively open, and the key for developing countries is to maintain the system of rules, so that this World Trade Organization that helps to keep them open and keep any country, but rich countries and more powerful countries in particular, from backsliding.
So I want to thank you very much for being here, Kimberly Ann Elliott, who is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and the author of several books on international trade policy, including agricultural policy. And she will be speaking this Thursday, February 14th, in a lecture sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations at 5 o'clock at the Forum on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, talking about global economic challenges. Thanks for spending all this time with us.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. That's the website where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. Ciao.